Chapter 9. Cocaine Charlie. When Wilson returned from Pakistan, Joanne Herring announced that everything was in place to give President Zia a reception he would never forget. At vast expense, she had turned the main dining hall of the Houstonian Hotel into an exotic vision of a Pakistani palace. The heads of all the major oil companies had accepted, along with a surprising number of other CEOs from the Fortune 500. As she saw it, this was to be his coming-out party, designed to introduce America to the real Zia ul Haq. She had both Charlie Wilson and Charles Fawcett scurrying about from table to table, changing place cards up until the very last moment. In deference to the guest of honor's Muslim sensibilities, she even banned alcohol for the evening, but the congressman skirted the problem by occasionally excusing himself to meet Baron Ricky de Portanova at the hotel bar for fortification. The event resembled one of those typical charity balls, which always seemed to end with droning laudatory speeches. But Joanne Herring had summoned her powerful friends for a purpose, and when she rose to introduce the Pakistani leader, she had a surprise for them. "I want you all to know that President Zia did not kill Bhutto." Buckets, Baroness de Portanova, could not believe her ears. She knew how much Joanne liked the president, but she winced as her fellow minutewoman proceeded to deliver an impassioned defense of Zia's role in the hanging of his predecessor, the former Pakistan president, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto. "Bhutto had a trial," Joanne told the hushed gathering. "He was found guilty. President Zia did not commute the sentence because the constitution of Pakistan is based on the Quran, and the Quran believes in capital punishment. Zia did not murder Bhutto." It was a curious maneuver, and if nothing else, Herring succeeded in stealing everyone's thunder. No longer could her guests harbor confidential thoughts about Zia's treachery. But it was hard not to feel a little sorry for the dictator, forced to sit there with a genial smile as his honorary consul carried on. American liberals and human rights advocates would never change their view of Zia as a third world thug, but his American visit was something of a triumph, and Joanne's dinner was part of the reason it succeeded. The Reagan administration was trying to encourage him to hold the line in Pakistan against the Soviets, and this state visit was part of that persuasion process. Zia had dangerous decisions to make in the coming months about the CIA's involvement in his inflamed Northwest frontier, and all of them centered on whether he could trust the United States. Joanne's startling toast was strangely therapeutic for the much maligned leader, who remembered how quickly Jimmy Carter had turned on him. In Houston that night, Joanne Herring saw to it that a host of powerful Americans actually honored him. And that same night, Charlie Wilson provided yet another dimension to Zia's growing partnership with the United States when he took the general into a side room for a private talk. The congressman had a novel proposition for the Muslim dictator. Would Zia be willing to deal with the Israelis? This was not the sort of proposal just anyone could have made. But by now, the Pakistanis believed that Charlie Wilson had been decisive in getting them the disputed F-16 radar systems. As he saw it, Wilson had pulled off the impossible. Now the congressman in his tuxedo began to take Zia into the forbidden world where the Israelis were prepared to make deals no one need hear about. He told Zia about his experience the previous year when the Israelis had shown him the vast stores of Soviet weapons they had captured from the PLO in Lebanon. The weapons were perfect for the Mujahideen, he told Zia. If Wilson could convince the CIA to buy them, would Zia have any problems passing them on to the Afghans? Zia, ever the pragmatist, smiled on the proposal, adding, "Just don't put any Stars of David on the boxes." With that encouragement, Wilson pushed on. Just the previous month, he had learned that the Israelis were secretly upgrading the Chinese Army's Russian-designed T-55 tanks. In Islamabad, he had been startled to see that the Chinese were supplying Pakistan with T-55s. The congressman now proposed that Zia enter into a similar secret arrangement with the Israelis. "I was trying to rig it for Israel to do the upgrade without the Chinese operating as the middlemen," Wilson explained. It was no simple proposition. 3 years earlier, a mere rumor that Israel had been involved in an attack on the great mosque in Mecca had so radicalized the Pakistani Muslim population that thousands had stormed the U.S. Embassy in Pakistan and burnt it to the ground. Zia was mindful of his people's hatred for both Israel and the United States, and he might have been expected to nip this in the bud. Instead, he encouraged Wilson to continue. The congressman was acutely aware of the minefield he was walking through. Publicly, Pakistan and Israel would have to remain foes, he conceded. But, as Zia well understood, Pakistan and Israel shared the same deadly foe in the Soviet Union, and the fact was that each could profit mightily by secretly cooperating with the other. If Zia would follow the lead of the Chinese, Wilson said, he could increase the striking power of his tanks, and there might be other areas of military and technological cooperation where both countries could mutually profit. Pakistan did not have diplomatic relations with Israel, and Wilson certainly had no authority to serve as a quasi-secretary of state. In fact, with this kind of talk, the congressman was walking dangerously close to violating the Logan Act, which prohibits anyone other than the president or his representatives from conducting foreign policy. But as the two rejoined Joanne's party, Zia left the congressman with an understanding that he was authorized to begin secret negotiations to open back channels between Islamabad and Jerusalem. Wilson would leave for Israel in March and travel on to Pakistan to brief Zia immediately afterward. The entire evening had been a fantasy manufactured by Joanne to set the stage for Charlie to perform his magic with President Zia. It had worked beyond their expectations. As they compared notes at the after-dinner party that Baron de Portanova threw at his River Oaks mansion, this unusual Texas couple suddenly felt as if, together, they could conquer the world. The CIA has a polite ruse for keeping senators and congressmen out of its hair. Whenever a member not on the House or Senate Intelligence Committee calls to request a briefing on a secret operation, the agency always returns the call. The representative says they would be more than happy to accommodate the request, but, and this is a mere formality, of course, could the member please clear it with the chairman of the appropriate Intelligence Committee? The catch, however, is that members of the Intelligence Committees are as human as anyone else. Information in the Capitol is power, and Intelligence Committee members don't like sharing it. Thus, the CIA regularly manages to ignore the hundreds of individuals in the Senate and Congress who don't possess a key to the secret bureaucracy. The strategy is different, however, for members of the Foreign Affairs and Military Affairs Committees. The agency talks to these committee members but doesn't feel obligated to offer much inside information. Charlie Wilson's Defense Appropriations Subcommittee is another matter. It controls the CIA's budget, even if historically its members haven't concerned themselves with the details of agency operations. Yet here was Wilson enthusiastically seeking a meeting with someone in the CIA who had the authority to act on the Afghan problem. At first, the agency merely dragged its heels, but after he was put off repeatedly, Wilson discovered, quite by accident, the magic words for summoning a high-level officer. "Don't worry," he innocently said to a deputy director at Langley who was explaining on the phone how busy they all were and how difficult it would be to come over to the Capitol. "I'll drive out there myself. I'll come this afternoon." Bureaucrats at the Pentagon and the State Department consider it a boost to their ego and prestige when congressmen travel to their offices, but the CIA doesn't work that way. It is a forbidden place, so Wilson was not exactly surprised when his offer to pay a visit yielded a rather quick call back from Langley. The agency's Near East Division Chief, Mr. Charles Cogan, would be in the congressman's office at 5 that afternoon. The female members of Wilson's staff, the Angels, were fascinated by the bustle of activity that preceded Cogan's arrival. The technicians came first, almost an hour before the appointment, looking like doctors with stethoscopes hanging from their necks. They probed the telephones, cleared the congressman's office, and moved about listening to his desk and walls. One of them explained that the KGB could place a beam on the window pane from far away and pick up everything that was said inside. By the time all of this curtain-raising activity had concluded and the two CIA technicians had tucked themselves away in an adjoining office to monitor any suspicious probes, the Angels were eager to see what this Mr. Cogan would look like. Right on cue at the stroke of 5, Charles Galligan Cogan, accompanied by two dark-suited aides, swept through the outer office and into Wilson's. But in that fleeting moment, the Angels had glimpsed a figure out of another age. Kogan moved with the ease of the great natural athlete, exuding the air of a master spy. At 55, the old Harvard man was still riding to the hounds and hammering the goals at polo. Wilson was impressed, just as the CIA man had intended him to be. But for the congressman, everything that followed was devastatingly anticlimactic. I had 1,000 questions for him. I wanted to know about frostbite, sleeping bags, boots, food, more Kalashnikovs, and always the problem of the anti-aircraft weapons. I needed to get a feel for what was going on, particularly to find out if they needed something. But Wilson soon realized that this Mandarin of the Near East Division had come for no other reason than to patronize him. Kogan was pulling out all the stops with his noblesse oblige routine, exceedingly gracious, appreciative of the congressman's interest, full of impressive facts about the geopolitical situation. But in the end, he made it clear that it was rather premature to consider any new initiatives.